Okay, sorry about that. Now, how did the Second World War affect your community? And you know, of course, one of the observations that have been made about the effects of the war was it wasn't necessarily in the effects of government policy during the Great Depression. It wasn't really President Roosevelt's New Deal legislation and all the various programs that helped bring the nation out of the war. I mean, they helped, but they didn't really draw the nation out of the Depression, excuse me. It was the war that really, and the huge expansion of the wartime economy, that kind of pulled the United States out of the Depression. What do you remember about that? Did your family experience any kind of significant shift? And in your community, did it experience any kind of significant shift with the onset of the Second World War?
Yeah, well, just prior to the war coming along, mm-hmm. It seemed like the economy got just an incredible boost in the arm when Roosevelt came out with the WPA program and some other programs. And I guess the pay was really horrible, of course, but in those days any pay was great. So suddenly when Roosevelt came out with some of these programs, suddenly every family had a few dollars, and it seemed like it was the morale just seemed to soar once these WPA and some other programs started. And then when the war broke out, then I think that really created an economic boom because there was a shipyard in Bellingham that was about 20 miles away, and it started hiring people. And Firestone Tire opened a plant, and they were making parts of the aircraft there. And it just seemed like when the war started, suddenly everyone went to work. And those people working on the WPA, for example, if I recall right, they were getting $40 a month, and then they would combine that with $50 or whatever they were getting from their farming efforts. And so, income was getting up there around $90 a month. And then when the war came along, I think suddenly, salaries pretty much doubled with all these war plants, and it seemed like there was then suddenly jobs for everybody. Oh, and another thing that might be worth mentioning is living right there on the border. Before we got into the war, there was a steady, not a huge stream, but a steady trickle of young men coming through Blaine, mm-hmm. heading north into Canada. And this may sound a little strange after the Vietnam War, but going into Canada, their goal was to get into Canada to join the Canadian military forces, because Canada was already involved in the war with Germany, mm-hmm. and we weren't. So these were young men fleeing into Canada. To some of them, I remember coming through town, said they wanted to get up there and join the Canadian Air Force and things such as this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, let's see. After the outset of the outbreak of war and the declaration of war, especially against Japan, after they attacked Pearl Harbor,
uh-huh.
and we went into a full war footing, how did the war affect your community, being on the Pacific Coast, of course, because of fears of a Japanese attack along the Pacific Coast of the United States?
Oh, I think after the first few months, when there were a few months after Pearl Harbor, I think everyone then started to realize, you know, they're not really going to be attacking the coast here. But all along the coast at that time, they have blackout restrictions. For example, there could be no bonfires along the coast at all. And I remember, and I never did know the truth of this, but I remember we heard rumors that submarines had come up, Japanese submarines had come up right off the coast of Oregon. But other than that, I don't think we were affected really any more so than probably someone living in Kansas as far as feeling that we were really threatened.
Well, did your family participate in many of the drives and other activities during the war?
Oh, yeah. One of the activities that they were active in and they got me involved in also, and most of this was mainly time I was a freshman sophomore in high school. But they had watchtowers scattered around the country. And this is where people would go and spend a few hours. They were manned 24 hours a day. Okay. When you got to the watchtower, you had a phone there and a pair of binoculars. And any time an airplane would come, you'll hear an airplane, you'd have to get out and get all the information you could on it and immediately dial in that this all the information you had about this airplane. And sometimes it was kind of a tough job because the phone lines there were party lines. There might be 10 or 15 people on one line. Mm-hmm. So when you'd spot an airplane and get on and you'd pick up the phone to try to phone it in, there would be someone on there, and sometime you'd have a little argument with them to get them off the line so you could report the plane.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's see. What else do you remember about the war? Was there a local movie theater where you were able to go and not just watch movies but see some of the news footage coming back from the war?
Yeah, it seems like Movie Town News was the big thing then.
Yes, sir.
Of course, we've got almost all of our information by radio and the newspaper. Mm-hmm. But that was often more important than going to see the main film, was mm-hmm. to see the Movie Town News. Mm-hmm. And that was more excitement and so forth about that. And then as, you know, I got up toward my senior year, some of the kids and some of the other boys in my class started talking seriously about enlisting in the services. Mm-hmm. And I was somewhat interested, but actually the main thing that kept me back was if I went in the service, that would stop me from playing basketball for a year or two, and that was far more important to me then. Yes. And one boy actually got drafted. He was about 2 years old, you know, he'd been out of school for 2 years. He was about 2 years age-wise ahead of us. He did get drafted right out of school. And unfortunately, shortly after he got drafted, his father was killed in an automobile accident, so the service released him immediately. But in my junior and senior year, then we started knowing a lot of our close friends who were just a year or two ahead of us who were all going into service. And some of them would come back for a short leave, and of course we all sort of looked at them in their uniforms as kind of big heroes. And most of us, the attitude sort of was, well, when we're 18, they'll come and get us, and then we'll be ready to go.
Okay. Well, let's see. Is there anything else that you recall about growing up in Blaine, Washington during the Great Depression and the Second World War?
Life was seemed pretty quiet and uneventful. There was not a great deal of crime. Mm-hmm. People were all very helpful to each other in those days. Mm-hmm. And that got instilled in me early. I remember quite a number of times I would get a call about 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening. Some frantic farm wife would get hold of me and say that the man of the farm was sick or something happened. And could I possibly come down and milk his 20 cows?
Oh,
and quite a number of times I did just that. I remember going down to their farms and sitting out there in the barn till maybe 8 or 9 o'clock at night to get all those cows milked. And then when I was going to high school, it was a little different then. It was a mile. We had to walk 1 mile to catch the school bus. And sometimes the weather was extremely grim. Mm-hmm. So we had to get up very we had about a few cows of our own. I used to have to get up extremely early, milk the cows, get ready for school, walk a mile to catch the bus.
Oh my. How many cows did your family typically have?
Well, I think it varied between 3 and 6.
Okay. And how long would it typically take to milk them?
It was interesting milking cows. Some were easy to milk and some were extremely tough. Some like to kick and give you a real bad time. I would say, I'm making a wild guess now, but I would just say it would take between 7 to 10 minutes to milk a cow.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But one thing, your grip, your hands got extremely tough and high and pretty powerful after all that milking.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I do remember one time in one night counting our cows and another farmer's cows. I think this was the most I ever had. I did milk 27 cows in one night.
Oh, my.
And I probably didn't do a very good job because when you milk by hand, there's such a thing called stripping the cow. That is, after you get most of the milk out to take a great deal of effort to strip out the last bits.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're milking 27 cows, you probably get a little sloppy.
Yes, sir.
When you get near the end of them.
Understandably so. Well, did you have many brothers or sisters growing up?
I had two sisters. One was 3 years older than I was, and one was 5 years younger.
Okay.
And the one that's 3 years older, as soon as she graduated from high school,
mm-hmm.
she seemed kind of famous because she got a job at the state capitol down in Olympia, and everyone was very envious of that. That how in the world could a high school kid get a job like that, coming right out of school?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And. Well, as the Second World War was drawing to a close, was there any, I guess not necessarily anti-war, but were there any people in your community that weren't very supportive of the war or were in opposition to fighting?
No, I know of no one who was really opposed to it.
Okay.
However, in our immediate community, there were a lot of Germans,
mm-hmm.
and some of these Germans weren't citizens.
Okay.
And so, as I recall, there was a requirement back in those days that any of these Germans who weren't citizens,
mm-hmm.
they could not be out away from their homes after dark.
Okay.
And I remember frequently at the little community store nearby hearing different people say, Fritz down there, he was out at 9 o'clock last night. I wonder if we should report him.
Mm.
And then there were some Germans in the area, and I certainly wouldn't say that they were anti-American, but I do remember some Germans gloating at how rapidly the German army defeated the French. I do remember him saying, well, you just can't underestimate these Germans. They're really good, tough people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there was any real strong feelings against the Germans, but some people were kind of keeping an eye on them. And then we had a lot of Italians, some Italian communities,
mm-hmm.
and now they didn't come under any suspicion at all like some of the Germans did. But I think there were comments like, sort of degrading the Italian army, and I think some of these comments kind of rubbed the Italian community wrong. But other than that, I don't think there was any, it seemed like the war effort was pretty much universally, completely supported by everyone, of course.
Yes, sir. Okay. That's funny. Did anybody point out that defeating the French army was nothing to brag about, or was there very much derisive humor about the French, like there has been more recently with their opposition to the war with Iraq?
There was some ridicule of the French,
mm-hmm.
and I think that probably carried over to a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
and I guess it even some of that even rubbed off on me,
mm-hmm.
because. I think I was a little bit critical of the French, but all that ended years later when I had some long personal conferences with Dr. Bernard Fall,
mm-hmm.
and I had a chance to talk to And when I talked to the Vietnamese years later and found out what they thought of the French soldiers, my opinion of the French and the French army completely changed.
Wow, that's very impressive. That'll be interesting to get to.
Yeah.
As the war was coming to a close, and the United States had, obviously was going through Germany very well in 45. When we turned our sights to Japan and dropped the atomic bombs, how did that? What do you remember about that? The use of atomic weapons by the United States against the Japanese, and how did your family and your community respond to that?
Well, it all came so fast because I do remember that this Firestone company that was making fuel tanks for our aircraft, they had big advertisements in the paper for more help. You'll see, Germany was pretty much through, and they had advertisements say we still need a lot of workers. This war is going to go on for a long, long time. So, of course, it really came as an incredible surprise. And when it happened, I think it was sort of a general feeling of relief. I don't remember any people saying, oh, it was a terrible thing that we had to kill so many people to do this. I just remember mostly people saying, well, we sure saved a lot of American lives by doing this. And without exception, I think, of course, no one knew of all the other effects of the weapon. But I would say at that time it was 100%. Everyone was 100% for dropping the bomb and what we did.
Okay. What were the celebrations like during VE Day and then VJ Day?
Well, out there in these little towns like this, I think that mainly it was just a little bit of a horn honking and going to an extra movie or something like that. But there was really no wild celebrations. Now, of course, we heard a lot about what was going on in Seattle, which is about 100 miles south. We heard about big celebrations there. And then in the movie town news, of course, we saw a lot of the big celebrations. But there was no really wild celebrating, just a lot of joy. Well, now the boys are going to be coming home. But every time anyone mentioned something about, well, now all our boys are going to be coming home, they would always say, gee, it's great, all our boys are going to be coming home, but I wonder if they're going to be able to find a job when they get home. You know, but we wonder, you know. And as soon as they started, the first few of them started to trickle home, I forget what the numbers they called it. It was 52, 40, or something like that. Anyway, every one of them, as soon as they arrived home, they said, wow, now we can draw for a year, for 52 weeks, we can draw a certain amount of unemployment compensation. Because obviously there was quite an adjustment period right after they started coming back.
Well, was there a large influx of soldiers into your community at the end of the war?
Only those. No one came to our community other than just the boys who lived there when they left.
Okay.
You know, it was just the. But about that same time, I do remember there was a large influx of people of a Mennonite religion coming from back east.
Okay.
And I remember there was quite a bit of hostility toward them coming into the area because the thought was, we've got enough people around here now that having a hard time, and we don't want a bunch more coming in. And then it was kind of an unknown religion that drew a lot of suspicion. So that caused a little bit of problem, but nothing really serious.
Well, what was the predominant faith of the area?
Where I lived in this area, Pleasant Valley, we had what they called the Pleasant Valley Community Church, and that was the only church in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of what anyone was, that's where what they were. And I think you could say that most of the people in the area were probably, there was a certain number definitely of Lutherans.
Mm-hmm.
We had quite a few Norwegians and Swedes and so forth in the area. And Lutherans, Baptist, Methodist, it was pretty much a Protestant type environment.
Okay. Now, and you were brought up under in a Protestant faith?
Yes.
Growing up, what did you think about the suspicion of the Mennonites and how they were treated?
Well, you know, really there wasn't any adverse, there was no physical treatment.
Mm-hmm,
it was
right,
just
right.
People talking against them.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, my feelings sort of was, you know, well, they are different, but they don't seem to be bothering anyone. And some of the boys that were Mennonites, I soon found out that they were, you know, pretty decent people. And also something that concerned me somewhat was I found out that being in the same classroom with them was pretty tough because they were all really good scholars.
Hmm.
And that raised the academic level a little.
Yes, sir.
So by and large, we absorbed them into the community without, you know, any real big problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, just shortly after you graduated from high school, in that was in 1945, is that correct?
Yes. Uh-huh.
You went ahead and joined the military?
No.
Oh.
I graduated when I was 17.
Okay.
And I knew I was going to have to go into service soon, but I thought, I am going to try to sneak, get 1 year of college in before I go into service. Mm-hmm. And I had been in contact with an assistant coach from Washington State University, and I think this was before they gave out scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
The school would just contact you and sort of say, you know, you might want to come down and try to get on our team, and if you come down here, what we can promise you is we can promise you a job on campus in which, you know, you can earn pretty much most of the money you're going to need.
Mm-hmm.
And so after hearing this, I decided I was going to Washington State, which was a big step for me. That was 350 miles away. So when I went over there, I found out it was basically the coach. He just heard of me. You know, he just knew I was there. And it was up to me to, you know, they had tryouts. In those days, it was a lot different than now. There would be signs on throughout the campus, basketball tryouts are going to be conducted. And when they first started, they'd have so many try out one night and so many the next. And I think all in all, probably about 90 different kids were out for the tryouts.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there were about 5 or 6 veterans from the previous year that didn't have to worry about being on the team. And then it was the big suspense of the coach gradually each night lopping off a bunch of names. And so when I first got there, they said, you know, well, you can have this job. I forget the pay, but it amounted to somewhere around $45 a month, and you were actually putting in time working.
Okay.
Well, once I made the team, then I got a different job. It was $60 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And you still had to put in a little time, but not near as much time as you had to for the $45. So it was so different than you know what you see on the athletic programs today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's see. When you just to clarify, in what year did you first join the military?
Oh, I went in the military on September of 1946.
September of 46.
Wait, let me make sure. Let's see, I got out of high school in 45,
right.
And then I finished my first year at Washington State in June of 46.
Okay.
And then I, right after, see, I'd already been called to take the draft physical.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to... In the summer I got out, I went to the draft board and I said, okay, how soon are you going to draft me?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, you know, because of the, you know, overall world situation and so forth, it's hard, we can't really tell when we're going to draft you, but it's going to be some months away. So I had a job around, you know, a temporary job for the summer, and I thought, well, I'll just see if they call me while I'm working on this job, and then they didn't call me. And then I wanted to, I didn't want to start school another year and get called in during the school year. So then I went and down and I enlisted. And at that time, you could enlist for just 18 months. So it was in September 46, I enlisted for 18 months. That's when I first went in.
Now, is that under a specific MOS specialty?
No. There were no promises, no guarantees, no bonuses, no nothing. You know, you just signed up for 18 months, and that was it. And I think the pay was up to $50 a month, which at that time we thought was pretty good in that, of course, we were getting room and board and everything.
Mm-hmm. What was your MOS when you got in, when you finished your basic training?
Oh, well, no, I took basic training at Fort Lewis. Basic training was only 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then things got a little confusing. They put me on a train and sent me down to Camp Stoneman, California, and I was on my way to Japan. But while we were at Camp Stoneman, something quickly changed, and they shipped us from Camp Stoneman and put us on a ship at San Francisco, and of all things, they sent us back up to Seattle, which is just a few miles from Fort Lewis. And then from Seattle, we left, and I was assigned up in Alaska. And I think I was assigned in about the most dismal and remote spot in the world. It was a little place called Whittier. It was a port. It was a deep water port where all of the supplies and equipment for Alaska came in at that time. And there was no road leading out of Whittier. There was only a railroad. And to get out of Whittier, there was one tunnel that was 2 miles long, and then there was another tunnel a half mile long, and the train would have to, you know, go through these two tunnels to get up to Anchorage. And I started it when I first got there. They put us all at work unloading ships and loading the freight cars to take the stuff, you know, up to Anchorage. And after I'd been working out there on the docks for about a month and a half, the lieutenant stuck his head in and said, hey, we desperately need someone who knows how to type. Well, in high school, that was one of the sissy courses I took, was typing. And so when I said I typed, he grabbed me right away, and they put me up in a ration breakdown, the commissary ration breakdown office, which was an incredibly interesting job. Because I not only computed how much food we had to order for the troops there at Whittier, all the different types of foods and how many, but also we had about 30 different Army tugs and barges that came in, and they would draw food once a month. They would come in and get supplied once a month. So I would have to figure how much food each one of these, of every kind of food each one of these barges got for a 30-day period based on the number of people they had. So I ended up having an extremely interesting and challenging job that I often spent 10, 12 hours a day on. But in a place like Whittier, where there is absolutely nothing there, what else are you going to do besides work? And the weather was such that a number of times during the year, we lived in these Quonset huts. We had to get up on top of the Quonset huts with our shovels and shovel off the heavy snow that was piling up on the Quonset hut. So we had, at Whittier for that year, there was absolutely nothing to do except go to movies and work. And but I overall, I found it an interesting and reasonably enjoyable assignment.
Yes, sir. Well, when you went to basic training at Fort Lewis, what was that introduction to active duty military life for you?
Well, I thought it was quite a bit different than what I expected. When we first got there, I remember the first day when we fell out, and the sergeant, and of course he was an absolute god to us, But he yelled at us in a very threatening tone. He says, "Okay, tomorrow morning we are going to fall out here at 0600. And then he said in a very threatening voice, "And any of you who aren't here are going to be absent." Well, I thought, well, he's probably dead right there. And then I remember when we'd get in formation there, and he'd say, "Forward," and everyone would lean forward, and he would say, "Okay." He says, "I don't want you leaning forward like the Leaning Tower of Persia." And I thought, well, he might mean Pisa. But any event, I think we just had a real colorful, I just remember this very colorful first sergeant that we had. And it was kind of seemed like a hit and miss thing, because the barracks were extremely crowded where we were staying. We were all double decked, and there weren't more than just several feet between each barrack. But I do remember that we were all surprised at how good the food was. And sometime to get into the mess hall, we used to have to wait in a line about a block long. But actually, at Fort Lewis, you know, once we got into our basic training and so forth, I found it a very, I pretty much thoroughly enjoyed basic training. And about 30-some years later, I had the opportunity, one of my last duty days, I spent in that barracks where I took basic training.
Okay. Well, what was the most challenging part of basic training for you?
You know, physically, I was in extremely good condition, and so the running, the exercising, it was a physical camp, and I don't think any part of that was at all bothersome. I remember a part of the training that I disliked the most. I remember I never liked fooling around putting weapons together. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like many times other people could get a machine gun or a BAR, they could get it put together faster than I could, and that kind of frustrated me. Mm-hmm. But all in all, I found basic training pretty interesting and somewhat exciting 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you didn't really go through any kind of specialty training after that?
No. From there, this was a point in time when they were bringing soldiers home, mm-hmm. you know, as fast as they could, and they were just rushing bodies over to replace them. And so we had no advanced training of any time. From our basic training company, when we finished, practically the whole company just had these orders that you guys are going to Japan. And that's when we got loaded up and sent down to Stoneman.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what was that trip like for you, the first time outside the United States?
Going to Alaska?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we went up on an extremely crowded ship. Mm-hmm. I remember there were bunks, probably about four or five levels high, and there was so little room between them that if you were laying on your bunk and you put your knee up in the air, you were jamming the back end of the guy in the bunk ahead of you.
Oh, my.
And other than it being extremely crowded, some of the little things you remember, they had a boat drill, and I never, once I got on the boat, almost every bunk had a life preserver on it, but I never had one on my bunk. So when we fell out for the drill, here I am without a life preserver. Well, along came the sergeant and was really extremely upset that I didn't have a life preserver. And he said something to the effect that if I didn't have one, there were plenty around there that I could have grabbed. Well, of course, I would have been grabbing someone else's. So I remember for a good part of the trip, he put me on a special duty. I was running around the ship with a can of some kind of Brasso or something, shining all the rails. And I used to think what a nasty guy he was. And then what was strange is once we got to our destination in Alaska, once I became in charge of ration breakdown, he is the guy who's in charge of all the mess halls in the area. So he and I started working together very closely, and strangely enough, we became good friends.
Well, Well, that's interesting. Okay. And then describe the area in which you worked, if you would, when you arrived in Alaska.
Oh, well, first getting there when I was working on the dock, mm-hmm. it was a big primitive dock where the ships would come in, and there's always a race to get them unloaded as fast as possible because there was always another ship out there waiting to be unloaded. And the railhead was right there. And most of the time, my job was not in the bowels of the ship so much. I was up on the pier where we were loading stuff onto the forklifts and then taking it and sticking it in the freight cars. And I would always remember that once in a while, some kind of a big box would break. I don't know if it broke accidentally or if someone broke it, but sometime a big box would break and things like some candy and stuff would fall out. And, of course, then it was a free-for-all as to who grabbed that stuff that was laying around on the pier. And I didn't really like that job, I was pretty happy when they called me and told me that because I typed, I was going to another one.
And where did you go from there?
Well, that's when I went into this commissary,
okay.
the ration breakdown office, okay. where I spent my time figuring out the rations.
Right. Okay. Now, working in that system, how was the supply system working at that point?
The ration breakdown?
Yes, sir.
Well,
Was there any shortage of anything? Was there pretty much everything you needed?
Well, it was interesting. There was these, all these master lists. And, you know, like we were supposed to have so much lamb a month, so much beef. They had different kinds of beef, roast and fry, stew and boil, and ground beef. And where I used to have trouble with the ships was they would come in, and on their inventory list they would have that they had a full stock of lamb. And because they didn't want to be issued any more lamb, they wanted to be issued more beef, of course. So I used to have to kind of fight with some of them to tell them, hey, no matter how much lamb you say you've got, you better start using it because you're going to get the same percentage of lamb that everyone else is getting. But I think the rations, I don't think, were really great. I used to marvel when I would issue the stuff out the mess halls. I used to marvel at what our mess personnel could do with the stuff to make it go round. I would say our food was fair, but it no way compares with the food that soldiers are prepared, given nowadays. There was an awful lot of ground beef meals and things like that. And it definitely wasn't eating high on the hog, but it was adequate.
Okay. And let's see. And you stayed there for the rest of your time?
Yeah, I was there almost up till, right till my time was up. Mm-hmm. Then they put us on another ship and sent us back to, that little fort on the edge of Seattle. I can't believe I forgot the name of it. And when we got there, we thought we were going to be there for about 2 weeks processing to get out. Mm-hmm. But the day we arrived there, an officer walked in and said, we hope to have you on your way out of here within the next 2 days.
Wow.
And so within 2 days, we had what was called the ruptured duck,
mm-hmm.
A little device to show that we were separated from the service. Mm-hmm. And as I recall, we got $100. I think we got a total $300 when we got separated from the service. We got $100 the day we got out, and then for the next 2 months, they mailed us another $100. So when we walked out of there, we all thought that we were extremely rich.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you in Alaska, what was the morale of the unit like there, and the men that were serving there?
By and large, I would say that it was not good at all, mm-hmm. And of course that's because there was just absolutely zero, nothing to do except go to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very, liquor was very, very tightly controlled. No if you were underage, there was no way you were going to get any liquor. And once during your year stay there, you could get a 3-day pass to go to Anchorage, which is not exactly the world's best R&R center either. But other than that, there were some streams not too far away where you could go salmon fishing. And one thing that I got into a little bit during the summertime was mountain climbing. And I remember climbing up a one hill and just sticking my head over a ledge, and I found myself looking just a few feet away from me was this black bear standing there staring at me as my head was coming over the ledge. And fortunately, he turned around and kind of just gradually loped away. But other than getting out in the hills and hiking around and going to movies, it was a year with just absolutely nothing to do. And, of course, there was not a single, there was a civilian company who was about a mile away, and I think they had two women employees. And so on that installation, I would guess there was about 800 soldiers in this civilian installation, and two women. So it was an unusual environment.
Yes, sir. Let's see. And there were no cities or towns or anything like that.
No. The only town you could get, only town anywhere around was Anchorage, and I forget how far it was, but it was a several-hour train ride. And, of course, the train was pretty slow. It had to go through those tunnels and so forth. But other than Anchorage, there was just absolutely nothing. And I did get up to Anchorage this one time, mm-hmm. but something went wrong. I got a real bad case of ptomaine poisoning mm-hmm. about the day I arrived in Anchorage. So mm-hmm. my whole time in Anchorage, I spent laying on flat on my back, really sick.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. Well, what were your plans upon getting out?
Oh, well, my thoughts on getting out was immediately, of course, going back to college, and which I did. And when I went back to college, this is sort of where I got tied up for future military activities. When I got out of the Army, I was like everyone else who got out at that time. Well, I got my time behind me. And boy, are they never, no one is ever going to get me to spend another day in the Army. And I think that was the attitude of practically 100% of us who got out. Well, when I went back to college, I used to have to walk past the office of the ROTC department. And every time I'd walk past, this one sergeant would yell out something at me. Hey, now that you're an old, experienced, know-it-all veteran, now is the time for you to sign up for this ROTC program. And he said, let me tell you what this ROTC program means. He says, it means that in addition to that big $75 a month GI Bill check you're getting, it means that you would get an extra $27 a month, which, you know, he's talking big money. And daily he hit on that with me. So one day I said, well, let me hear a little more about it. And he said, well, if you take this ROTC program, it doesn't mean a dang thing, because you get your money, you get commissioned as a second lieutenant when you get out, and if there's a war, you're going to get called in as a second lieutenant. But he says they're not going to call you in as a second lieutenant unless they're calling in everyone else. So he said, you've got your choice. Take ROTC, get $27 a month, and get called in as a second lieutenant if we ever have another war. Or don't take ROTC, and then when we have another war, you're going to get called back in as your old rank, which my rank when I got out was a buck sergeant. And so the more I thought about that, the main thing was, gee, that $27, that looks pretty big. So that's how I ended up signing up for the ROTC program.
Okay. When you signed up for ROTC, did you have a particular branch in mind?
Not really, but about the only thing anyone knew about in those days, no one really knew much about anything except infantry.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really have any branch in mind. And, you know, signing up, it took a certain amount of courage to sign up for ROTC because there was an awful lot of harassment.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing bitter or anything, but just awful lot of good-natured harassment on the day that you wore your uniform around campus. And I'm sure that chased off an awful lot of people. But when we first went in, it seemed like the only thing any of them ever talked about was infantry. And it just seemed to me like, in the back of my mind, I just knew there were other branches like engineers or Signal Corps, but the thought always was, well, to go into engineers, you have to be majoring in engineering in college and things like that. So it just seemed like infantry was what everyone sort of gravitated toward.
Well, when you went to Washington State the first time, immediately after high school, what was your major?
Oh, I don't know why, but I immediately went in majoring in business and administration. And I guess I did that primarily because I didn't know what else to major in. Mm-hmm. And my high school coach had often mentioned to me, you ought to go and major in physical education and be a coach. Mm-hmm. But then in the back of my mind, I always remembered how he told me that he was always flat broke and he didn't make any money. And I remember he was driving around town in a much older, more dilapidated car mm-hmm. than a lot of the students were. And so I thought, well, maybe that coaching isn't all that, big a deal after all. So I didn't really know what I was aiming for, but business administration sounded kind of interesting, and so that's how I got into that.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so that's how it changed.
Yeah.
Okay. When you, let's see. With ROTC, in addition to your coursework, were you able to do anything else in school as far as playing sports or anything?
When I went back to Washington State, I got back there for the spring semester,
okay.
And I started going out for basketball. Well, they had spring basketball practice,
mm-hmm.
And so I immediately went out for that. I was enrolled in ROTC. But then one of the first disasters of my life hit. My mother got extremely ill, so I had to leave school just before the semester ended, and I had a difficult time getting credit for my classes because of that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, at that time, my parents had been living out not south of Seattle, so I had to rush home, and that was the first time I was ever on an airplane, was when I flew from Spokane back to where my parents lived. And then my mother passed away. And then I sort of lost interest in going that far away from home again. So then I sort of set my sights on switching school and going to the University of Washington, which was in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you transferred over with your mother's illness and everything, were you able to pick up fairly quickly?
At school?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't really notice too much difference in the schools. One of the first things I did, of course, is I went to the University of Washington ROTC program.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was some kind of an administrative follow-up that didn't mean anything. Somehow or other, they got me listed as being in the Transportation Corps, which I never was, but that's what went on all my transcripts. ROTC Transportation Corps, but I was actually in infantry all the time. And, University of Washington, of course, immediately seemed like a much more interesting place than Washington, D.C., because Washington State was out in the middle of the farmland, just a little tiny town called Pullman nearby. And there at the University of Washington, right on the edge of Seattle, and it was just a much more interesting place to go to school. And it seemed like there was a much better variety of classes and so forth. So I didn't have any trouble adjusting real fast. To show you how different conditions were in those days, another student and I got a room very near the campus, about three blocks away, in a very nice house, and we each paid $20 a month for the room. And, of course, with me getting $75 from GI Bill and that big $27 from ROTC, I was quite wealthy going to school at that time.
Okay. When when you transferred, how about your classes? Were you able to take most of your previous year and semester with you?
Most of my credits transferred right with me. I had no trouble with that.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, so I just picked up, I just went from Accounting 1 at Washington State to Accounting 2 at the University of Washington, and it didn't seem to be any real problem whatsoever in shifting schools.
Okay. And, let's see, was there the atmosphere of the two schools, were they very much different?
Oh, just a world of difference. At Washington State, it was, you knew so many of the students on campus at Washington State. It was a much, much smaller school. At the University of Washington, it was just such a huge, school. And there were so many more activities on campus, so many more things you could do. And it just seemed like a far more interesting environment. And another thing, like at Washington State, because there wasn't much to do, it seemed like things like alcohol was more of a problem there. And I'm sure at Washington, I'm sure they had their share of heavy drinkers, but, you were with your own crowd, and you just didn't see what was going on campus-wide. You were, just more in your small part of the campus.
And what about your major? Did that ever change when you transferred over?
No, I stayed majoring in business, mm-hmm. And then between my junior and senior year, that's when we were required to go to the ROTC summer camp at Fort Lewis.
What were some of the challenging aspects of ROTC and for instance, summer camp?
Well, I really liked ROTC at the University of Washington. I think I felt like I had the opportunity to get to know the instructors better than I did at Washington State. We had a couple pretty old, hardened World War II veterans there at the University of Washington. And they seemed to be, really genuinely interested in, teaching us and getting the material across to us. And I don't think I found any of the classes extremely difficult. I definitely was not one of the, in the college ROTC, there are some people who are super eager beavers in ROTC. That's their main goal in life is the military. When I was taking ROTC at the University of Washington, I don't think the thought of going into the regular Army really had entered my mind at all yet. And so I would say I was just sort of an average ROTC student. The highest cadet rank I had at the University of Washington was I was first lieutenant, platoon leader. And, of course, there were so many students in the advanced ROTC program didn't have any line job at all. Mm-hmm. So just being a lieutenant platoon leader was kind of showed a little advancement. But by and large, I just thought that I just looked at ROTC as kind of an interesting. And I think another thing in college ROTC at the University of Washington, I think I got to know my classmates in that class better than I got to know the classmates in any of my other classes.
Okay. And what was the student population at the University of Washington?
At that time, I would say it was total of between 20 and 22,000.
Wow. It's a big campus. What about the ROTC program? About how many cadets?
Well, now, this is kind of a wild guess. I would say that in our junior class, the class that went to the ROTC summer camp at Fort Lewis, I would guess there would be would have been between 110 to 130.
Okay. And how did that compare with Washington State?
We had more advanced students, probably about almost double the number of students in the advanced program, junior and senior year, as they had at Washington State.
You're talking about ROTC here?
Yeah, uh-huh.
What about the student body population?
Well, at Washington State, I believe at that time the overall campus enrollment was around 9 or 10,000, about half of what it was at the University of Washington.
Okay.
However, at Washington State, sometimes I was in bigger classes, more a lot more students than some of the classes I had at University of Washington.
When you, as you were going through ROTC classes, especially as you progressed into the third and fourth year of ROTC, did the ROTC instructors, again, I guess the World War II veterans, did they start invoking some of the lessons that they had learned in war and combat, instilling some of that, passing all some of that knowledge on to you as cadets?
Yeah, you know, there was a certain number of war stories, but not a great deal. You know, by and large, they pretty much stuck to the basics. But you know, sometimes, and it was usually more in informal conversations, you would get something from them about some of their war stories.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, they just pretty much. You know, they didn't seem to be trying to really impress us with what they'd done.
Well, not necessarily try to impress you, but provide real-world examples of you know, leadership in combat, the challenges
uh-huh.
of leading men in such a difficult situation, so many challenges. You know, looking at it and reading about it in a book is, of course, not necessarily the same as being out there and doing it for real. And so providing that real-world juxtaposition to what you might have been reading in some of the training manuals.
Well, in looking back, I think that ROTC probably stressed more of the things like weapons training, small unit tactics, map reading, more of that than they actually dwelt on leadership. You know, we didn't have a lot of leadership cases and examples and
mm-hmm.
and what you should do in different situations.
Okay.
That's one thing that kind of surprised me a little bit about ROTC.
Yes, sir. Okay. And, of course, while you're in school during this time, the Korean War broke out.
Yes.
How was that... how did that affect you? How did that affect your student population, your fellow ROTC cadets?
Okay, the war broke out. I'm trying to exactly put it together, but the war broke out when probably when I was a junior, or I think it broke out in the summer, June of 1950.
Yes, sir.
When I was I just finished my junior year.
Mm-hmm.
In May of 1950. And so in my class, it didn't really have an impact on, because with all of us being juniors, of course, all of us said, hey, we're going to finish and get our fourth year in and get our commission. And so I definitely do not remember any loss of any of our students. Now, as I recall, we just heard of some students who graduated a year or two ahead of us starting to go into the service. But at the end of my junior year, I did something unusual. Now it all comes back to me. Because I was a vet, you know, my enlisted time, I had to take just 2 years of advanced ROTC. And then I was able to get my commission before I got out of college. So at the end of my junior year, another student and I found out about that we could go to the infantry officers basic course at Fort Benning during the summer, you know, between our junior and senior year. So the two of us, during the summer, we went down to Fort Benning and went through this, and I forget whether it was, I guess it was about an 8-week Infantry Officer Basic Course. And the Korean War, as I recall, broke out during that time. So then when we got back to campus, the Korean War was in its infancy. And, of course, our goal was to finish college and get our degree. But we already had a commission. And so the Korean War actually impacted on us very little, except shortly after the Korean War started. I remember while we were going to school hearing about a boat, a ship that was coming back to dock in Seattle that had Vietnam veterans on it. And these Vietnam veterans, the bulk of them were young people who had sneaked into the Army underage, like they joined up when they were 16 or something. And when the war broke out over there, they said, hey, we're not keeping these 16-year-old kids over here. We're sending them back. So they had quite a boatload of these underage guys coming back. And I remember a couple of us slipped out of school and went down to the pier and watched the unloading of these guys and the celebration of these guys coming back. But by and large, when the Korean War broke out like that, it seemed to have very little impact on us at that time.
Okay. Now, was there any kind of an impetus for you to finish up and get out as quickly as possible so that perhaps you could get over there?
Well, the only thing was we just all knew, you know, we're going to stay here and get our degree. Mm-hmm. And then we all pretty much thought for sure mm-hmm. that once we got our degree and got out, we were all, it was in the back of our minds 100% for sure that mm-hmm. we're probably without a doubt going to get called up.
Yes,
and then I think we followed the Korean War probably much more closer than most kids on the campus did.
Yes,
and then it was kind of confusing because, you know, right after Incheon, mm-hmm. well, you know, the first few disastrous months, then right after Incheon, when they started moving north rapidly, mm-hmm. then there was kind of a big let up. Well, you know, it's all going to be over before, you know, we get out of college. It's, so it was a lot of uncertainty. But while we were going to school right after the Korean War started, I don't remember it really having much of an impact on us at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you, let's see, were you still in school and were you still in ROTC when Truman fired MacArthur?
I'm not sure, but I think so. I'm pretty sure. I forget what year and what month he fired him.
Yeah, I can't remember.
But I'm pretty sure that we were, and I believe with Ridgway. I believe seems
his,
like I remember Ridgway.
Right.
Take
It would have been in '52 sometime.
Uh huh.
I'm pretty sure. I mean, obviously it was before Ike won the '52 election.
Uh huh.
So. I didn't know. Were you still in school in 1952?
It seems like I wish I had my dates lined up here. It seems like I went into the service
mm-hmm.
in 1951.
Okay.
I hope I got my years right there. But, yeah, I went in, and the Korean War was still, you know, it was all going on pretty hot and heavy when I went in 51. And it was kind of strange, you know, when I was getting out of getting ready to graduate,
mm-hmm.
You know, I contacted the military and I said, okay, are you going to be calling me up? You know, I want to know as soon as possible and as much as possible. And they said, well, you know, based on, you know, the people available coming and going, right now it's hard to say. We might be calling you in and we might not. There's a good chance. They said it's a good chance that you will not be called up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was a little bit on edge. You know, I thought, well, I really am reluctant. Well, incidentally, when I got out of school, you know, I interviewed for a job, and one of the first things they asked me was, what's your situation with the military? And, of course, I had to tell them. And so everything was kind of uneasy. And so finally, after not knowing, I went out and I talked to the sergeant and I said, well, if it looks like I might be called up, let me just go ahead and volunteer to be called up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that way I'll know what I'm doing. And he said, yeah, we can arrange that.
Mm-hmm.
So I volunteered to be called up at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, anything special you'd want to do? And I said, well, yeah, I'd like to go into Army Aviation. So I put in to go in the service and get into Army Aviation. And surprisingly, that's the last I ever heard. I still have a copy of my of that letter I sent in volunteering for Army Aviation, but I never ever heard of it again from the Army. And so once I told him I wanted to go in, then very shortly after that, I got orders and was sent down to Fort Ord.
Okay. Well, let's see. Why don't we take a break for a moment?
Yeah.
This will conclude the interview with Mr. Bayless on the 15th of May, 2003.